Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. The crisis in Ukraine and Crimea was a story which continued to receive a lot of airtime this week. On Tuesday, the story took another new direction when Ukrainian troops were prevented from entering their military base at Belbek by Russian-affiliated forces. On Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Cathal McQuilla spoke to former Russian advisor Alexander Nekrasov about Russia's stance on Ukraine.
But I want to talk about what happened yesterday. Those television images that people all over the world will have been struck by and really worried by when Ukrainian forces, Ukrainian air crew in this case, were carrying their own flag in their own country, were prevented by whether Russians and our pro-Russian elements prevented from entering their own base. Now, you tweeted about those scenes as follows. Western hacks should be ashamed of making a fuss about that provocation by a bunch of Ukrainian troops outside the Belbek base. How can you describe military forces trying to enter their own military base as a provocation?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm surprised you mentioned this, because a lot of people have told me here in Britain that this was a clear-cut provocation. You know, a group of people, by the way, one of them was holding a Soviet flag, which I couldn't understand at all, who have brought a lot of press with them and who were filming everything, were walking down the road with singing, pretending that they were going to work.
Can I just stop you a second? They were singing the Ukrainian national anthem and trying to enter their own base. Now, okay, the media, of course, were obviously brought along, but a provocation?
Of course a provocation. It followed, by the way, by that so-called ultimatum, which was on all front pages, by the supposedly given to the Ukrainian troops by the Russian army, which was not true, but it was in all papers, and then they just had to concede that, well, probably no, there was no ultimatum. And then this followed. And finally enough, on that day, before that so-called heroic march to the base, our foreign minister said there will be a provocation against our troops, just you watch.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. If Russian forces in Russia were prevented from entering their own base by a group of armed men, Russia would be cross.
Well, excuse me, Russia is not inflamed by tension and instability and on the verge of civil war and run by a bunch of neo-Nazis. So you say that there are only a few of them. Excuse me.
Can we just stick to the issue of what we were talking about, Mr. Nekrasov? Let me finish my question. Ukrainians were prevented from entering their own military base in their own country. Now, how can that be a provocation?
What you are saying sounds of propaganda as well, by the way. Because this is ridiculous, comparing it to Russia and the situation in Ukraine, where there were neo-Nazis and racists moving and anti-Russians moving to Crimea. How can you compare this to Russia? And how can you, by the way, say, oh, they are not all Nazis in the government? If you have one Nazi in one European country, you'll have an uproar in the government. And you're saying to me, no big deal, four Nazis in the government, that's no big deal. Excuse me, you can't say that. And how about...
I did not say that. Can we return to the issue that I asked you about?
Cathal McQuilla talking to former Kremlin advisor Alexander Nekrasov on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. There was another row in the late debate on Thursday night regarding Russia's behaviour in Ukraine, this time between Dmitry Linik from the radio station Voice of Russia UK and Oleksiy Solohubenko of the Ukrainian section of the BBC World Service.
I'm not saying that this is President Putin's fault, what happened. All I'm saying is that everything that followed doesn't really address the key targets, the key aims of Russian foreign policy vis-a-vis Ukraine. If it wanted to have a friendly neighbor closer to Russia, away from Europe, closer to Russia, away from America, member of the customs union, what has happened after the events in Ukraine and what has happened with the introduction of what we know is Russian troops in the Crimea and the threat of annexation and referendum, I think creates huge problems for President Putin. I see lots of risks.
For Ukraine,
and for the
EU as well.
Absolutely. And so, if that was the reason to destabilize Ukraine, yes, that's an achievement. If that was the reason to have a weaker and more dangerous situation on the Russian border.
Are you saying that's Putin's doing, or what? destabilization of Ukraine?
I'm saying that this is the result of his policy.
Russia didn't meddle in Ukraine until the Crimean situation.
Are you serious?
I am, yes.
Are you saying that there was nothing in terms of telling Yanukovych that don't go to the European Union, here's our offer of money, you're better off with us? Is that not interference?
That's a normal political intercourse.
From Thursday's late debate with Audrey Carvel. On Wednesday's drive time, meanwhile, Mary Wilson spoke to Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, who gifted Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. Mary asked her what she thinks would have been her great-grandfather's view of President Putin's actions relating to Crimea.
It would never have occurred to him. That's why, I mean, I'm pretty certain that if he ever thought, if he dreamt in his wildest dreams that that could happen, that would be, you know, the Soviet Union would no longer exist at all, he would never have even taken that step. That I'm certain about. I've been conflicted on this issue, whether he would use tanks or use troops as President Putin did in Crimea. And first, my first initial reaction is that he would, because as a Soviet leader, that's what they do. I mean, they, when they feel that their policies, their politics, their unity is threatened, they use tanks. I mean, Khrushchev himself used tanks in Hungary in 1956. So my first initial reaction is that he would have, but then I thought he probably wouldn't. And the reason he wouldn't, I think, is because when in 1968 his successor, much hardliner leader of the Soviet Union, Leonid Brezhnev, sent tanks into Czechoslovakia in 68 to suppress Prague Spring, Khrushchev, who was still alive, he died in 1971, who is still alive, he said, this is really horrible what's happening. It has been 12 years since Hungary, and we haven't learned a better way.
What do you think President Putin wants now? Do you think, as some suggest, that he has this expansionist policy, that in some way he wants to put the old Soviet Union back together again?
I don't think he wants to put the old... He knows he can't put the old Soviet Union together again. But he's certainly being a very brilliant opportunist, a political opportunist. He saw an opening, and since Crimea has always been sort of a disputed issue between Ukraine and Russia, he saw that opening and he decided to take it, because one of Putin's great stands is that he is a very strong leader, a grand leader of Russia, and he is putting together pieces or sort of restoring Russia's glory, and people like Khrushchev, for various reasons, squandered it away. Then Boris Yeltsin in 91, the first Russian president, did not claim Crimea back. And so Putin does have this idea that he's a unifier. I mean, I'm not sure I would go that far as he wants to put together the empire, but he certainly, if he can't take the pieces back or some pieces back, he certainly would.
Nina Khrushcheva, the great-granddaughter of Nikita Khrushchev, talking to Mary Wilson on Wednesday's Drive Time. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, following President Putin's press conference on Wednesday, Cathal McQuilla spoke to the Russian ambassador to Ireland, Maxim Preshkov.
President Putin said at his press conference that Russia would not regard as valid an election which took place in what he called the current situation of terror. Mm-hmm. Now, how can Russia be satisfied that an election would take place and that Russia would accept the result?
To stop terror, that's all. To disarm these militant gangs which are controlling several parts of Ukraine. That's all.
Who will do this? Who will ensure that it's done to Russia's satisfaction?
Not us, not Russia.
Well, who will do it to your satisfaction? Who might do it?
Who might do it? Europe. They began this havoc. They began this work with the then opposition, part of which is our militants.
Ambassador, is that a serious suggestion that the EU could unilaterally disarm and bring about a peaceful situation, in Russia's view, in a place like Crimea, where Russian forces and pro-Russian forces have been out on the streets, among other things, holding up Ukrainian forces. I mean, surely Russia would have to have an involvement in some way in satisfying itself that an election was taking place in a peaceful atmosphere.
We will be satisfied, I can stress, only if these elections would be without involvement of military groups, of armed groups, of extremist groups, and that's all.
The Russian ambassador to Ireland, Maxime Preshkov, talking to Cathal McQuilla on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Enda Kenny also issued a statement on the situation in Ukraine and Crimea this week, and we also heard about the telephone conversations between Barack Obama and President Putin. In terms of a telephone conversation between Enda Kenny and President Putin, however, although you might not have heard about it on any news reports, you will have heard it almost live on last night's Callan's Kicks.
Mr. President, we have Prime Minister on phone.
Of what? US? UK?
Of the People's Republic of Ireland?
Ah, of course, it is March already. Put him through, Medvedev. Dobrechen.
Hello, President Putin.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, Prime Minister Benny.
What? No.
Thank you for the call. Enjoy eating all the shamrocks. Goodbye.
No, hold on a minute. It's not Paddy's Day.
It's not?
No, it's not.
Then why am I bothering to talk to you?
Sir, I am the Prime Minister of Ireland.
Bankrupt, powerless state.
Part of the European Union.
Another bankrupt, powerless union.
We were presidents of Europe last year, I'll have you know.
Sure you were. And I am president of Ukraine right now.
And that is why I'm calling you to condemn your invasion of our neighbours, the UK, and the strongest possible terms.
Wait, you say UK?
Yes, the United Kingdom, our closest neighbours. We have a long history with them. Admittedly, most of it is a history of them invading us. But notwithstanding...
Prime Minister, you are mistaken.
Let's get down to it. Do not think of invading us. We will fight you on the bogs, in the abandoned industrial parks, on the ghost estates. We have not invaded
UK. We are protecting our brothers in Ukraine.
The Ukraine? Should I thought you owned that yoke already, no?
As I said, we are not invading Ukraine, merely ensuring order. In the last year, we gave them subsidized oil and gas.
Wait, no, oil and gas, what?
And $17 billion in aid.
$17 billion, really?
Yeah.
President Rasputin, you wouldn't be interested in a little island getaway now, would you?
What?
Granted, it is a bit run down, could do with a few billion in home improvement. It's a bit of a fixer-upper, if you know
Russian
what I mean.
Federation is not interested in Irsk.
Set in the middle of the Atlantic with easy access to America and the UK.
Within intercontinental ballistic
and fracking rights in Cavan.
Gas!
Yes.
I like gas.
Gas, yes.
Prime Minister, I think we might have a deal.
From last night's Callan's Kicks. The two life sentences handed down to a 30-year-old man on Monday for raping two little girls in Athlone last September was one of those stories which stopped us all on our tracks this week. Irish Independent Legal Affairs editor Dervil MacDonald was in the Central Criminal Court for that sentencing, and on Tuesday morning she told Sean O'Rourke about the effect which the case had had on her.
I've been a legal affairs correspondent for the best part of 12 years, and I've sat in on many rape, murder, manslaughter trials, and you really see the whole gamut of what humans can do to each other. But really yesterday was just absolutely striking, and anyone who is involved in the administration of justice, whether it's judges or barristers and solicitors and prison officers and Gardaí and any amount of people, you know, they operate extraordinary levels of professional detachment to go about their business. Same for my colleagues who are court reporters, who have to sit and listen to very difficult material every day. And yesterday, that level of professional detachment seemed to just break down near unanimously.
And from the bench, Mr. Justice Paul Carney, who has, I think, some 20 years of dealing with these kinds of cases, he said that hard-boiled members of the press, as he called you, broke down during some of the evidence or some of the recounting of it. Now, we obviously don't want to go into the harrowing details of what those children suffered, but it seems that few people could listen to it without feeling a terrible level of disgust.
Yeah, as I said this morning, as the sobs of the parents reverberated around the courtroom, there was just a cacophony of mourning sounds, gasps, shocked sighs, weeping, including my own. I'm not afraid to say that I shed tears too. There was a prison officer who just was crouched with his head in his hand. There was one of my colleagues had just dropped her pen. She had her head on her hands and she was crying openly. And that was just kind of replicated throughout the difficulty etched on the faces of the barristers involved. And Judge Carney, just observing all of this, what was remarkable was, you know, you hear victim impact statements, sometimes they're read into court, but to have seen those parents, like one of the fathers just... only for the fact that he was sitting down, I don't think he would have been capable of standing up. Him and his wife supporting each other. Their victim impact statement was read out, and the eloquence and dignity of it was just, it was mind-blowing. The mother describing how, you know, she said that inside I'm slowly dying. The father of the 9-year-old girl paying tribute to his daughter, saying their dignity and courage had taken her breath away. The father of the 6-year-old girl got into the witness box himself. He said he wanted to be able to show his daughter in years to come that he had done this for her. It was absolutely striking. He described the impact on the child and his family through the human senses of touch, of sight, of smell. I couldn't even write down parts of it. It was so, so difficult. And he was just yards away from the man in the box. It was just really extraordinary. What was heartening, there was very little that was heartening about yesterday's hearing, the love and support that those children will have. One of the fathers said he hoped that in time this would become a faint memory. He said that we've all been touched by evil, and I don't think he just meant his own families and that of the other young girl, but I think society has been touched by this evil. It's absolutely inexplicable.
Dermot MacDonald talking to Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. Another court case which received a lot of coverage this week was the trial in South Africa of Oscar Pistorius for the murder of his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp. The story also developed a local angle on Monday when callers to Liveline rang in to draw Joe's attention to a bet available on the Paddy Power website inviting punters to bet on the outcome of the trial. When Paddy Power came on air, Joe was making no bones about where he stood on the matter.
Take it off.
Joe.
It's outrageous. And you know it's outrageous. Take it off. There's no argument in this. There's a Joe. woman's life you're talking about, having a novelty bet on. Now, Paddy, I let Aideen talk to you, but you know you're wrong on this one. To actually have a premeditated murder charge verdict as a novelty bet, 1-5 guilty, 3-1 not guilty, the bets are void should the charge be changed from premeditated murder, vets are void should a mistrial be directed, bets will not be accepted on the market from permanent residents of South Africa. Take it down.
So... can I just talk, just to tell you a little bit about it for a second, right? So the so we're betting on the outcome of the trial, and this is basically as the background, and I'm sure you've talked about there, I wasn't listening, so apologies, but the background to this is that this is the highest profile trial that's probably ever been. You know, there's got this unprecedented media access to it. You can walk around the house on the BBC website, the dedicated 24-hour news channel, dedicated Twitter feed. It's going to be played out in public. There's going to be cameras and audio in the courtroom. I mean, this is at a new level. It's like O.J. Simpson on the O.J. Simpson trial on steroids. And the reason we're offering odds on it, Joe, is not because it's a murder trial, because we don't offer odds on murder trials generally. The reason why we're offering odds on this is because it's the only topic of conversation all around the world, at every water cooler, in every pub. People are talking about it. People are speculating as to what way the trial is going to go,
you,
what's going to happen with it.
The reason you're offering odds on it, Paddy, is that you'll make money out of it.
The reason we're offering odds on it, Joe, is to provide our customers the opportunity to bet on something that everyone has an opinion on.
And you hopefully will make money out of it.
Well, I don't think I think it's unlikely we'll make very much money now, considering we're going to give money back to all those bets if he's found not guilty and if he walks away. So it's I think it's not going to be a big money spinner for us, Joe. It's more of an indication that you can bet on unusual things. And when something is a huge topic of conversation like this is around the world, that people do have a strong opinion on it. We're giving them the chance to put their money where their mouth is.
And what else are you thinking of having bets on?
Well, there's various things, you know. We're like obviously all the regulars, when we're coming up to Cheltenham and things like that. But I mean, why not
have bets about where the next plane will crash?
Because I don't think that's in particularly good taste.
Exactly. Why not have bets on the number of people that will be killed in car accidents next week in Ireland?
Well, Joe, I mean, you're taking this down the wrong little route, I think, because basically the thing is here, as I'm saying to you, we're reacting to a global media story and offering odds on it from that perspective. That's the reason we're offering odds, because everyone's talking about this and it's something that everybody has an opinion on and people do talk about and do wonder how the trial is going to go, and that's the reason why we're offering odds on it.
Paddy Power talking to Joe Duffy on Monday's Liveline. A number of callers rang in to air their views on this particular story. And on Tuesday's programme, Andrew Furlong, whose daughter Nicola was murdered in Japan less than 2 years ago, gave his reaction to the Paddy Power bet to Joe.
I couldn't believe the audacity of the man. The novelty bet? I mean, if one of his kids were murdered and I went into his Paddy Power office and a trial coming up, and I said I want to put a fiver on the outcome of the bet, what would he say back to me? Just because of somebody in another country, like they have family, they're going through exactly what a lot of other people are going through. And he has the audacity to turn around and say it's a novelty bet? No, I don't buy that. Money racket.
Because when Nicola was murdered and then the trial just over a year ago was a big, big story, rightly so, because it was a crime, and a heinous crime committed by those individuals. And Paddy Power's argument was, well, everyone's talking. Well, we know everyone was talking about Nicola's murder here because it was so horrific and the trial. But his argument was, well, everyone's talking about it. What's wrong with letting people put a bet on it?
Well, if he had done the same thing when I out in Japan for Nicola's court case, mm-hmm. he'd have been the first man I'd have been seeing when I came back.
And what would you have said to him?
I wouldn't have said nothing. I'd have been looking at him on the ground. If one of his family had been daughter or sons or whatever murdered, and I went into Paddy Power, just Paddy, I want to put a fiver on the outcome of that trial of your son or daughter. You think he'd have it? You think he'd have me thrown out of the thing? It's just that he hasn't got it. It hasn't happened to him. So it's a novelty to him. But there's families in this country that has happened to. When I heard it yesterday, I sent you a text last night because I was getting more bitter as I thought about it.
Yeah.
So I think it's an utter disgrace.
I know it's the first anniversary of the conviction of Richard Hines is coming up just after Patrick's Day, and the second anniversary of Nicola's murder is coming up in May. How have things been since you came back from Japan and the ordeal there and then the trial? How have things been for you and the family, Andrew?
Never got any better. You're walking around in a daze. Never. You're thinking of her 24/7. When she was alive, you thought of her, but you knew she was going to come home. You knew you were going to see her. But now it's 24/7, now, like. She's not here.
Andrew Furlong talking to Joe Duffy on Tuesday's Liveline. The shooting of John Gilligan while he was attending a family christening in West Dublin last weekend received a lot of coverage at the beginning of the week. On Monday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, we heard from Father Danjo O'Mahony, the duty chaplain at Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown, who administered the last rites to the convicted crime boss.
We were all standing by. I mean, you have consultants there, you have doctors there, you have nurses there, you have all the crew there. Next thing was the ambulances arrived, two ambulances with their personnel, and also the Gardaí arrived in tow with them from Ronanstown.
So it was known initially it was John Gilligan coming.
No, we didn't know at all. We had no clue who it was coming in. We were given no name.
And at what stage did you realise who it was?
We copped on a while then from the personnel there, that when we saw the forms, you know what I mean, each of the ambulance people bring a form with them, you know what I mean, of who it is, etc., etc. So then we realised who it was, really. And we were saying, is that the real, you know?
And what happened then?
Well, obviously, they all worked. He was in great pain, I think. And all the staff there, the doctors and nurses, they worked very professionally on him. And they administered drugs and whatnot, and lines and tubes and whatnot. They did everything possible. There were 10 people working on him probably at the one time. They did a great job.
And what about your own role in this, then?
My own role was very simple. We normally, in these sort of situations, we administer the sacrament of the sick for these people with general absolution.
And was John Gilligan conscious at the time?
It's hard to know how conscious he was, really. I wouldn't be an expert on that at all. But I know I saw the consultant talking to him, trying to tell him what was happening and what they were trying to do for him. So I worked beside her, yeah.
And do you think he was aware that you were giving him the last rites?
I don't know. It's hard to know. I couldn't swear to that, Sean, you know. Probably was, I don't know.
What about the wounds, then, that he had suffered?
Well, you know, I'm sure it's well known, absolutely, you know, about the wounds he had. He was a lucky man, in a sense. He had wounds in his chest and wounds in his leg, and he, I think a bullet grazed his head.
And was there a general sense of drama then about...
Yes, he had blood everywhere, like, which is common enough.
Would you often see the results of a gun attack on somebody?
We have had gun attacks, yes, we have, yes, indeed, and stabbings and whatnot as well.
How long would you say the whole drama went on for then on Saturday evening?
Well, I mean, the thing is, eventually he was... brought from casualty in for a CT scan, and I left, and I had no business around then, and then I think later on he was brought to the theatre that night, and the following morning I saw him in the ward about 5 o'clock.
And how was he then? Was he awake?
He was asleep, yeah.
Father Danjo O'Mahony talking to Sean O'Rourke on Monday. Pat O'Connell became the country's best-known fishmonger when the Queen visited a stall at the English market in Cork a few years back. Well, Pat obviously made a bit of an impression on the British royals, because earlier this week he received a letter in the post which, as he told John Murray on Thursday, he could tell straight away contained something a little bit out of the ordinary.
And I opened it up, yeah, and it was an invitation to Buckingham Palace.
Lovely, lovely.
Lovely, absolutely.
And this is your first such invite.
I don't like cucumber sandwiches.
Well, maybe they'll do smoked salmon especially for you.
I was thinking of bringing my own, you know.
bring some vacuum-packed fish with you to London. So
I reckon that's why I'm invited over, actually. I reckon the Queen likes my smoked salmon.
You have to bring the salmon. P.S.
Bring
some salmon with you. So, and it was just a very formal letter, Pat, was it?
Oh, very formal, absolutely. Yeah.
It's on the 25th of March, yeah. You're visiting, and I think the President's first official state visit is on April 8th.
Yeah.
So the idea is to bring a few Irish in beforehand to look after them and let them see Buckingham Palace for themselves.
Well, I'd say it's probably to try and get a hang of the accents, you know.
And that'll be helpful for her understanding Michael Dee, do you reckon?
Well, I don't know, because he speaks nothing like Pat O'Connell.
No, that's right, yeah. And tell me, is it just a single invite, or is your darling wife Margaret invited as well?
It's just a single invite, and she's not speaking to me at the moment.
Oh, no. This is very bad.
I didn't issue the invite, you know.
Would you not send her in your stead, no? You know, would you not do the decent thing and send Margaret in your
stead? She doesn't have the laugh, John.
It is a bit disappointing, though, isn't it? Because it's a visit you'd like to share with your loved one.
I think it's great, John.
Yeah.
You haven't met my loved one, obviously.
The Queen's favourite fishmonger, Pat O'Connell, as heard on Thursday's John Murray Show. There are also plenty of laughs in the Mooney studio on Wednesday when Dr. Eva Orsmond, who you'll probably remember as the slightly scary doctor from Operation Transformation, joined Shea Byrne and Brenda Donoghue to talk about weight and, more importantly, weight loss.
I mean, there's so many, you know, myths and things that people are talking about. They say, okay, women, when they hit menopause, it almost feels like the weight suddenly, you know, falls on top of them. Seems like that when we get older, we have the right to start putting on weight. I was just having this conversation yesterday in my Kilkenny clinic with this lady. And I said, you know, where do you think you get the right to become heavier when you get older?
Well, people say when they're happier, they put on weight. It's like, we're happy, we don't have to think about it.
Yeah, until the point that you are very unhappy.
You know, and Brenda, and I think it's fair to say you've been through a few diets, and so have I, in my time.
Yeah.
Does it make you happy when you're on a diet, or does it make you miserable?
Well, no, I think the buzz, and actually this is something I'm dying to
I
ask.
Saw you were very proud when you said to me that you have lost 3 stone. You wanted to say to me, because you...
Brenda's not,
see
you lost 3 stone, yeah, you look fabulous.
Yeah, terrific, I know. Great.
You got your hair blow dried today, you look more fabulous.
You're confident to meet me today with the 3 stone less.
So you ran up to her, sat in your lap.
Actually, I would. I'd be totally self-conscious beside you. That is true. But what I want to know is, right, when you do all this and you're dieting and you're exercising, whatever, and suddenly, you know, you're not drinking as much wine and whatever, where is the outlet for fun to relax? So does the outlet become, I feel better in myself and I look better and that's enough? Whereas before, relaxing was maybe having a bottle of wine, meeting your friends,
you see,
having
that's
loads
open,
to
yeah.
eat. So where is the buzz
that's,
if you have to lose weight,
you know,
and maintain it?
I first of all think that maintaining weight, I think it's a continuous fight. I don't think it's something that happens easily. Like one lady came to my clinic and said to me, Dr. Eva, I want to just get over this weight and start living normally and never anymore have to diet. And I said, sorry,
Welcome, God join love her. The club.
God love her. She's, I could just see the sights aiming at her as she said that.
I do think we have to continuously watch it. Today, before coming here, I was off. I have to force to myself, Eva, go out, do your run. So yes, you need to exercise. You need to do these things. Mm. Especially in Ireland when there is a lot of fun and you can go have a few extra drinks and it's so easy to have too many extra drinks.
Yeah.
Obviously, to create this, that balance and be able to relax without that extreme, it's obviously the challenge that we all have to learn. And I don't have an answer for you, but maybe you can have grade six and a lot of men say to me, Eva, I'm now like I was when I used to be young, and I said, fantastic.
Skinnier people have better sex.
You see, you think about men now, for example, the blood is going into the wrong place, and now when you have lost the weight, the blood goes where it's supposed to go.
Dr. Eva Orsman, Shea Byrne and Brenda Donoghue as heard on Wednesday's Mooney. Now, the name Barney Curley will probably ring a bell with you since he's the man who pulled off that horse racing coup worth £3 million sterling at the beginning of the year. Journalist Nick Townsend has written a book about another betting coup orchestrated by Barney Curley in 2010, which he told Sean O'Rourke about on Tuesday.
In Ireland and in the UK and London, there was 30 altogether. Basically, their job was to rush round and as fast as possible, but as subtly as possible, to put bets on without attracting attention. So they went to the betting shops, they'd have a look and see, oh, is the manager around? If the manager's around, maybe we should nip straight out again because he could be a bit cute and he would realise what they were up to. So they target certain staff members. And it was all, this took months to prepare, with lots of research went into it.
Operation Chainsaw, it's called. And again, the memo, you've reproduced it in the book. And again, details like before you leave, make sure your phone is charged, bring your slips, bring your cash, basic stuff, you know, stuff, entering the shop, what to do. Approach the counter, relax, be confident. Is the cashier smart? If in doubt, pull the treble out or pull out completely. If in any doubt with powers, pull out. So it's all, yeah. I mean, they're told what to say, how to engage, look for maybe the more raw, the rawer person behind the counter,
yeah,
and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, the reason for this is that apart from one guy, these people were not, they were recruited because they were thought to be honest, trustworthy, but they weren't punters. A lot of them didn't really understand betting or horses at all. I think it was felt that once you start getting people who are regular punters to be involved, they will use the information to their own advantage. They wanted to restrict
that. So it was
that.
The low stakes placed in a load of betting shops by people, yeah, who looked fairly regular and ordinary, but doing it on a massive scale.
Yeah, I mean, they even went so far as to have football kit on to blend in with the local team so that they just looked like ordinary punters wandering in. And they wandered in, they were told to, watch a greyhound race. You know, don't look as though you're rushing around trying to put a bet on. You're actually regular punters.
How many bets did they get on then in the end?
It was hundreds. There were some in Ireland, some in the rest of the UK, a lot were in London. London was targeted because there are so many clusters of bookmakers together, so you go from one to another very quickly. You know, you can get seven in one high street.
And hence the folding bikes as well.
And the folding bikes and the underground, the tube trains and running.
And what about the races themselves then? They must have gone somewhere to watch all of these.
Barney sat at home and watched it very quietly, didn't get excited. The other guys, they put the bets on early, then they went to the base near St Paul's Cathedral and they just had a laptop with the thing being streamed and just sat there and watched it.
Nick Townsend talking to Sean O'Rourke on Tuesday. From bookmakers to book writers on Wednesday's Arena, we heard from first-time author Joanne Spain, who's just made it onto the highly prestigious shortlist for Richard and Judy's Search for a Bestseller competition. She told Sean Rocks how it all came about.
Last year I said I'd sit down and I'd actually do it. I have three small kids, so I didn't always have the time, but I got it done last year.
You have three small kids and do you have a full-time job outside of the house as well?
Yeah.
So where and how does the writing happen, pray tell?
Well, I just night times and weekends. It was really funny when that chap who worked in the civil service,
Donal Ryan,
Spinning Heart, yeah, when he got published and he was talking about working nights, and I was like, that was in the middle of me doing that, and I was saying, oh, I'm not alone.
What is the full-time job, Joanne?
I actually work with Pierce Doherty and the Doll.
So are you an advisor of some kind of his? Or
yeah,
what?
Parliamentary advisor, yeah.
All right, then. Tell us a little bit about With Our Blessing and what it's about.
Well, it's crime fiction, obviously. It's a murder mystery. I don't want to give too much away, but it's set against, there's an historical backdrop of the mother and baby homes and Magdalen Laundries.
So did you draw this from some sort of knowledge of that area of life, that from your own life, or where did you get the idea?
Well, I got the idea. The idea just came to me, but as it happened, when I was working on the book, I'd always known that my father was adopted, and I started looking into his adoption, and it transpired he'd been adopted from St. Patrick's Mother and Baby Home on the Navan Road. So I looked into his history and did an awful lot of research at that point, so that kind of improved the book as I was going along.
And if you do win this prize and you get to publish the book, will Pearse Doherty be looking for a new parliamentary advisor?
Oh, God, I hope so.
Joanne Spain talking to Sean Rocks on Wednesday's Arena. The original supermodel, Jerry Hall, was one of Miriam O'Callaghan's guests last Sunday. Now, the great thing about interviews with supermodels on the radio is that you're not distracted by how they're looking or how well they're aging. One thing, though, that you can't but be distracted by when listening to Jerry Hall is that wonderful southern drawl.
She was funny, my mum.
Remind us of what she said. What was it about, how to get a man or how to keep a man?
She had so many. She used to say, you know, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar. And she'd say, the man's the head of the family, but the woman's the neck and can turn him which way she likes. She was very funny.
And what was the one about being the maid in the living room?
Oh, God, the naughty one. That was a joke, actually. It was the way to keep a man is to be a maid in the living room, a cook in the kitchen, and a whore in the bedroom. And then I added, I'll hire the first two and do the last bit myself. Oh, well, you have to have a bit of fun in life.
You've lived your life in the public eye from a very young age. But have you found it difficult sometimes being in the public eye and maybe your personal life being put out there a lot?
I think sometimes it's more difficult for the people around me. Like, you know, my children, people I'm having relationships with. I'm, you know, used to it because I started doing it when I was 16. I don't pay any attention. I don't have a press agent. I don't read anything. I don't get involved. I just do it, you know. It's part of my job. It's not to me. It's not me. And it's not very serious, so.
Was there ever a moment when it affected you? Was there ever a moment that being in the public gaze?
Well, yeah, it was very annoying reading about your unfaithful husband. That was annoying. But no, that was a while ago. Ah, he's all right, Mick. He never gave me anything that, you know, antibiotics wouldn't cure. No, I shouldn't say that. So naughty.
And for our listeners who don't know, you used to be married to Mick Jagger.
Oh,
you stayed friendly, though.
Yeah,
didn't you?
Very friendly. I'm very proud of his achievements. They're quite ageist with him too, and they shouldn't be.
You mean the Rolling Stones still rocking?
Yeah,
everything.
I mean, you know, they're to be really admired.
Jerry Hall talking to Miriam O'Callaghan last Sunday. Today's rugby match against Italy is particularly notable because it marks Brian O'Driscoll's last international appearance in Dublin. And Friday's Today with Sean O'Rourke, his father Frank and former teammate Shane Horgan spoke about what it was that made him such a great player.
I suppose from a very early age, just watching his balance, that was probably the most important thing. He rode a bike without stabilisers, and you could see very clearly that he had a tremendous balance and coordination. I suppose that was it. That was when he was, what, 3 or 4 years of age.
But it's been noted that he took a little time to establish himself in rugby, maybe not quite making the first team at school level until maybe later on in his time there.
Yeah, he did. He struggled a little bit early on, but I suppose, like everything else, he just waited for his time to come, and then when it did, he made the best of it.
And what about determination? That seems to be one of his attributes, and people say as well that he maybe acquired his toughness from your good self.
Well, I hope to think that. But he's one of these guys that anything he does, he puts his mind 100% to it. He wants to do his best. Very, very, very competitive from an early age. And even if it was only playing me and golf, he always wants to win the money. And unfortunately, most of the time he does. but he's very, very determined.
And Shane Horgan, you, as I say, are a close friend. You soldiered close by Brian O'Driscoll. What difference did it make to have him on the pitch close by?
I think he sort of changed the way people viewed the Irish rugby team, and also, to a large extent, the way players viewed the possibility of succeeding. And I think a lot of that came from very early on in his career and scoring 3 tries against the French in Paris, something that had never been done before. And it was a change in time in Irish rugby as well, coming from, I suppose, a very low point in the 1990s, not being able to compete. And all of a sudden, it was a belief that we could compete, and here was a player that could compete with any player in the world. And it's interesting to hear Frank talk about his balance. And it's just, as soon as he said it, it reminded me of a story. I remember just before the World Cup, I think it was in 2007, and we had a little break beforehand and went down to a friend's house in Cavan, and it was water skiing. And I don't think Brian had ever done it before. And so he jumped up on the water skis and straight up, no problem, and hit a little bump in the water, hit a wave, and one of the skis shot off. And he managed to keep his balance on one ski and continued on water skiing like nothing had ever happened, on the first time he'd ever done it. And I was, this is just a freak. And that's the, you know, that's the balance. This, of course, he had the talent and he had, like, you know, the mental disposition. But when you have that sort of natural gift as well, you know, it was just incredible.
Shane Horgan and Frank O'Driscoll on Brian O'Driscoll, the well-known rugby player and lesser-known water skier, as heard on Friday's Today with Sean O'Rourke. Just before I go, have a quick listen to this little piece from Tuesday's John Murray Show. And who says we don't do any dancing on the radio these days? That was Irish dancer Ronan Morgan, who was in studio with John Murray on Tuesday, as was a young band made up of Joe Kearns, Joe Monaghan, Liam MacDonald and Daniel Noonan. Conor Brophy is up next on The Business. I'm Fiona Kelly. This is ABBA's SOS. So until next week, goodbye.
Where all those happy times, they seem so hard to find. I try to reach for you, but you have closed your mind. Whatever happened to our love, I wish I understood. It used to be so nice, it used to be so good. So when you're near me, darling, can't you hear me, SOS? The love you gave me, nothing else can save me, SOS. When you're gone, how can I even try to go on? When you're gone, though I try, how can I carry on? You seem so far away, but you are standing near. You make me feel alive, but something died, I fear. I really tried to make it up. I wish I understood. What happened to our love? It used to be so good. So when you're near me, darling, can't you hear me, SOS? The love you gave me, nothing else can save me, SOS. When you're gone, how can I even try to go on? When you're gone, though I try, how can I carry on? Save me, SOS. When you're gone.
can I even try to go when you're gone? Though I try, how can I carry on when you're gone? How can I even try to go when you're gone? How can I even try to go on?